Images of Rhea crowded my mind, feasting beneath the fruity boughs of the Shamora, showing me constellations in the darkest parts of the night sky, greeting Arbasa with a shower of dew on her face, wrapping her finger around my own, watching me, and the glowing Galator within the crystal cave. My only two friends gone in the same day! I slammed my fist against the moss-covered turf. It's always the same for me. Whatever I find, I lose. Shim's tiny shoulders drooped.
And there's nothing we can do to stop it.
I swung my face toward his. Oh, yes, there is. Wobbly though I was, I forced myself to stand. I'm going after her. Shim recoiled and nearly fell backward off the root.
You is full of madness.
Maybe so. But I'm not going to lose the one friend I have left without a fight. I'm going after them, wherever they took her, even if it means going all the way to the shrouded castle itself.
Madness!
Repeated Shim.
You is full of madness!
Which way did they go?
Down the river they is marching fast.
Then I will too. Goodbye.
Wait!
Shim grabbed hold of my knee.
I is full of madness myself.
Though touched by the little giant's intention, I shook my head. No, I can't take you, Shim. You'll just get in the way.
I is not any fighter, that is truly. I is scared of almost everything, but I is full of madness.
I sighed, knowing I was not much of a fighter myself. No.
I asks you, please.
No.
That girl? She is sweet to me, sweet like honey. I only wants to help her.
For several seconds I studied the upturned face by my knee. All right, I said at last. You may come.
Part 3. Chapter 25. A Staff and a Shovel. For hours we followed the river unceasing, clambering over smooth stones and low branches. Finally the river curled to the south, and we reached the eastern edge of Druma Wood. Through the thinning trees I viewed the bright line of the river, and beyond that, the shadowed plains of the Blighted Lands. From this vantage point there could be no doubt that the river unceasing had been the sparkling waterway that I had glimpsed from the dune on my first day on Finkaira. Downriver some distance, I could make out a group of egg-shaped boulders. They straddled both sides, and at least one sat in the middle of the waterway. The channel looked wider and shallower in that area. If so, it would make a good place to cross. On the opposite bank, a stand of trees had been planted in parallel rows like an orchard. Yet indeed, if it was an orchard, it was the most scraggly one I had ever come across. Twigs snapped behind me. I whirled around to see Shim struggling to get through some ferns. Several green arms wrapped around his stubby legs. As he twisted and jumped in the ferns, his floppy yellow shirt, hairy feet, and prominent nose combined to make him look more like a poorly dressed puppet than a person. But his coarse brown hair, still wadded with honey, dirt, and sticks, not to mention his fiery pink eyes, made it clear that he was alive and angry.
Madness,
he muttered as he finally broke free of the ferns.
This is madness.
Turn back if you like, I suggested. Shim scrunched his bulbous nose.
I knows you're thinking. You wants me not to go.
He drew himself up, which still made him only a bit taller than my knee.
Well, I goes. I goes to rescue her.
It won't be easy, you know. The little giant folded his arms and frowned at me. I turned my second sight once more toward the lands across the river. It struck me that everything, including the trees in the orchard, wore blander colors than I had seen in the Druma. Whatever vividness the rest of Finkaira had added to my vision would vanish as soon as we crossed the river. I had grown accustomed to seeing brighter colors in the forest, and even dared to hope that my second sight had improved. But now I knew the truth. My second sight was just as faded as before, as faded as the landscape in front of me. And as before, the strange reddish-brown color painted the plains beyond. All the eastern lands,
but for the black ridges in the distance, showed the color Rhea had described as dried blood. I drew a deep breath of fragrant forest air. I listened, perhaps for the last time, to the continuous whispering of the boughs. I had only barely begun to sense the variety and complexity of this language of the trees, sometimes subtle, sometimes overwhelming. I wondered what they might be saying to me even now. If only I could understand their voices. Silently, I promised myself that if I should ever return to this forest, I would learn its ways and cherish its secrets. Just above my head, a hemlock branch quivered, filling the air with spicy scent. Reaching up, I rubbed some of its flat needles between my thumb and forefinger, half hoping that this would make my hand smell forever of the forest. On an impulse, I wrapped my fingers around the middle of the limb. I squeezed tight as if I were clasping another person's hand. I pulled just enough to feel the branch sway. Suddenly, the branch broke off. Still clasping it, I tumbled into the ferns and onto Shim.
"You stupidly fool!"
The miniature fellow regained his feet, took a swipe at my arm, missed, and fell back into the ferns.
"What is you doings?"
he cried from the tangle of green fronds.
"You almost crushes me!"
"Sorry," I replied, trying hard to keep a serious face. "The branch broke." From behind the mountainous nose, two pink eyes glared at me.
"Shim almost broke!"
"I said I'm sorry." He stood again, growling furiously.
"I makes you sorrier."
Clenching his fist, he prepared for another swipe. Just then, I noticed the branch in my hand. To my astonishment, its bark started to peel away. At the same time, the smaller branches attached to the main stem began snapping off one by one, dropping their needles on my lap. The peeling bark rolled into large curls, then fell away, as if shaved by an invisible knife. Catching sight of this, Shim lowered his fist. A look of wonder filled his face. By now, the branch in my lap was no longer a branch. It was a sturdy, straight stick, thick and gnarled at the top, tapered at the bottom. Lifting it higher, I could see it stretched a full head taller than myself. I twirled it in my hands, feeling the smooth wooden skin. In a flash, I understood. Using the stick as support, I lifted myself from the ferns. Standing before the fragrant hemlock tree, I recalled my clumsy attempt to find a staff when I had first entered this forest. I bowed my head to the tree in thanks. Now I held my staff, and more precious by far, I held a small piece of the druma that would travel with me beyond its borders.
"You isn't going to hit me with that stick, I hopes,"
said Shim, rather meekly. I looked at him sternly. "If you won't hit me, I won't hit you." The little figure stiffened.
"I didn't want to hurt you."
I raised an eyebrow, but said nothing. Hefting my new staff in my hand, I started striding toward the egg-shaped boulders downriver. Shim followed behind, fighting through the brush, grumbling as much as before, but not quite so loudly. A few moments later, we reached the spot. Here, the river widened considerably, flowing over a bed of white stones. As I had hoped, the water, while still fast flowing, looked quite shallow. Beneath the boulders, the mud on both banks showed tracks of large, heavy boots.
"Goblinses," said Shim, observing the tracks.
"I'm sure the river unceasing did not make it easy for them to cross." Shim glanced up at me.
"Myself? I hates to cross rivers, really, truly, honestly."
I leaned against my staff, grasping the gnarled top.
"You don't have to do it. It's your choice."
"How far will you goes?"
"To wherever Rhea is. Since those goblins think they have the Galator in their sack, they are probably heading to Stangmar's castle. I don't know if we can catch them before they get there, but we must try. It's our only hope, and Rhea's."
My second sight scanned the shadowed hills in the distance. A wall of clouds, blacker than any storm clouds that I had ever seen, rose above them, plunging the easternmost hills in total darkness. Rhea's own description of the location of the shrouded castle came back to me. "In the darkest of the dark hills where the night never ends." I must find her before she reached those hills, where the night never ends. For in such darkness I would have no vision, and almost no hope. Shim swallowed.
All right, I goes. Maybe not all's the way to the castle, but I goes.
Are you sure? We won't find much honey over there.
He answered by starting to wade into the river. He made his way for a few paces, struggling against the water. As he neared the partly submerged boulder, though, he stumbled. Suddenly he found himself in much deeper water. He shouted, thrashing his little arms. I leapt to his aid just before he went under. Hauling him onto my shoulders, I began to cross.
Thanks, you,
panted Shim. He shook himself, spraying water all over my face.
This water is muchly wet.
Carefully, I stepped through the surging water, using my staff for support.
I'd be grateful if you'd keep your hands away from my nose.
But I needs a handle to hold on to.
Then hold on to your own nose, I exclaimed, certain now that I had made a mistake to let him come along.
All right,
he replied with such a nasal voice that I knew he was holding tight to his own nose. With every step through the rapidly flowing river, I felt something pulling backward against my leather boots, tugging me back toward the forest. It was not the current itself. Rather, it seemed that hundreds of invisible hands were trying to restrain me from leaving the Druma. Whether these hands were in the water or in myself, I could not tell. But my feet grew increasingly heavy as I neared the opposite bank. A feeling of foreboding swelled in me. At the same time, I felt an image forming in my mind, an image from some source other than my second sight. I saw strange lights, dozens of them, moving toward me. Suddenly, I realized that my hidden powers were at work. This was going to be an image of the future. No, I cried, shaking my head so violently that Shim had to grab my hair to avoid falling off. The image disappeared. The powers receded. Yet the feeling of foreboding remained deeper than before. As I crossed onto the eastern bank, Shim wriggled down from my shoulder, not without punching me in the ear, however.
Ow! What was that for?
For making me hold my nose all that way.
The thought of throwing him back into the river crossed my mind, but somehow I resisted, and my anger was swiftly crowded out by the closer view of the orchard. The trees, thin and tormented, looked considerably more frail than even the oldest trees in the Druma. Indeed, those farthest away from the river seemed positively sickly, mere ghosts of living things. We had arrived in the Blighted Lands. I approached one of the sturdier trees, whose branches draped over the river. Reaching up, I plucked a small withered fruit. Turning it in my hand, I puzzled at the leathery toughness, the rusty brown color, the wrinkled skin. Sniffing it, I confirmed my suspicion. It was an apple, the scrawniest apple I had ever encountered. I tossed it to Shim. Your supper. The little giant caught it. He looked unsure as he brought the fruit to his lips. Finally, he took a bite. The bitter expression on his face said it all.
You wishes to poison me.
I smirked.
No, I didn't think you'd take a bite.
Then you wishes to trick me.
That I cannot deny.
Shim placed his hands on his hips.
I wishes the girl is here.
Grimly I nodded.
I do, too.
At that instant I saw in the distance, beyond the last row of trees, a band of six figures marching out of the eastern plains. They seemed to be heading straight for the orchard.
Warrior goblins.
Their swords, breastplates, and pointed helmets gleamed in the late afternoon sun. I watched them disappear behind a rise. Although the slope hid them, their gruff voices grew steadily louder. Shim, who had seen them too, stood petrified.
What is we going to do?
Hide someplace.
But where? From where we stood, I could not even find a single rock to crouch behind. The withered vegetation offered no protection. The slope along the bank ran low and smooth, with not so much as a gully. The goblins neared the top of the rise. Their voices grew louder, as did the heavy stamping of their boots. My heart raced. I scanned the terrain to find any possible hiding place.
You,
whispered a voice.
over here.
I turned to see a head poking out from among the roots of the trees at the far end of the orchard. Shim and I dashed to the spot. We found a deep, newly dug ditch that had not yet been connected with the river. In the ditch stood a broad-shouldered, sunburned man with a strong chin and brown hair, the more so because it was flecked with dirt. Below his bare chest, he wore loose leggings of brown cloth. He gripped his shovel as effortlessly and as securely as a practiced soldier grips his sword. He waved at us with his shovel.
"Get in here, lads, quick!"
We did not hesitate to follow the command. I tossed aside my staff and dived into the ditch. Even as Shim dived in behind me, the goblins marched over the rise and entered the orchard. Quickly, the man covered us with dirt and leaves. He left only a small hole where each of us could breathe.
"You there!" called a goblin's voice.
From beneath the blanket of dirt, it sounded a bit higher, though no less grating, than the voice of the goblin who had led the band in the Druma.
"Yes," answered the ditch digger.
He sounded perturbed at being interrupted in his work.
"We're searching for a dangerous prisoner, escaped this morning."
"From who?" asked the man.
"From guards, you buffoon. Former guards, that is, lost their prisoner, then their heads."
He gave a high, wheezing laugh.
"Have you seen anybody cross this river? Speak up, man."
The laborer paused for some time before speaking. I started to wonder whether he might yet give us away.
"Well," he said at last, "I did see somebody."
Beneath the dirt, my stomach clenched.
"Who?"
"It was a young man."
Sweat mixed with dirt stung my lips. My heart pounded.
"Where and when?"
barked the goblin. Again the man paused. I debated whether I should try to bolt, hoping to outrun the warriors.
"A few hours ago," answered the laborer, "heading downstream toward the ocean."
"You'd better be right,"
rasped the goblin.
"I'm right, but I'm also late. Got to finish this irrigation ditch before nightfall."
"Ha! This old orchard needs a lot more than a ditch to save it."
Another goblin voice, slower and deeper than the other, joined in.
"Why don't we chop down a few of these trees to lighten this poor fellow's load?"
The whole band wheezed in laughter.
"No,"
declared the first goblin.
"If we're going to catch the prisoner by nightfall, we have no time to lose."
"What did they do with that fool girl?"
rasped another goblin as the band marched off, boots pounding on the soil. I pushed my head out of the dirt, too late to hear the full reply. All I caught were the words,
"Of the king,"
and a bit later,
"Better off dead."
I shook the dirt off my tunic. As the gruff goblin voices faded away, finally swallowed by the sound of the churning river, I crawled out of the ditch and faced the man. "I am grateful, most grateful." He planted his shovel in the loose dirt, then extended a burly hand.
"Hone is my name, lad. I may be just a common ditch digger, but I know who I like and who I don't. Anyone who is an enemy of those overgrown toads is surely a friend of mine."
I took the hand, which nearly swallowed my own.
"I am called Emrys."
I nudged the pile of dirt beside my foot.
"And my brave companion here is Shim."
Shim popped out, spat some dirt from his mouth, and glared at me.
"We must go now," I said. "We have a long journey ahead of us."
"And where are you bound for?"
I drew a deep breath.
"For the castle of the king."
"Not the shrouded castle, lad."
"Yes."
Hone shook his head in disbelief. The gesture revealed his ears, somewhat triangular in shape and pointed at the top, beneath the mat of brown hair.
"The shrouded castle," he muttered, "where the seven wise tools hewn ages and ages ago are kept. I remember when they belonged to the people. Now they belong just to the king." the plough that tills its own field, the hoe that nurtures its seeds, the saw that cuts only as much wood as is needed. He caught himself. Why do you want to go there?
To find someone, a friend.
He stared at me as if I had lost my mind.
Can you tell me where the castle sits?
Raising his shovel, he jabbed it at the air in the direction of the dark hills. That way. I can tell you no more, lad, except that you would be wise to change your plans.
That I can't do.
He grimaced, studying me with care. You are a stranger to me, Emrys. But I wish you whatever luck there is left in Finkaira.
Hone reached for his shirt beside the ditch. He pulled out a worn dagger with a narrow blade. He twirled it once in his hand, then handed it to me.
Here, you will need this more than I.
Chapter 26. The Town of the Bards. I strode across the tundra, trekking toward the rising waves of the dark hills. My satchel of herbs felt heavier now that it also carried Hone's dagger. As my boots crunched on the dry, crusty soil, my staff clicked against the ground. Every so often my shoulder rubbed against the staff's knotty top, and I caught a faint scent of hemlock. Shim, grumbling to himself about madness, struggled to keep pace with me, but I would not slow down for him. We had no time to lose. Over and over the goblin's words, "Better off dead," echoed in my mind. Despite the blades of grass, clumps of bracken, and groves of scraggly trees that managed to survive on this tundra, the dominant colors of this plain, stretching to the dark horizon, were dull grays and browns, tinged with rust. Several times I looked over my shoulder at the fading green hills of Druma Wood, trying to recall the lushness of that land. As the sun sank lower against our backs, our shadows grew longer and darker. I noticed in the distance a stand of dark, leafless trees. Then, drawing nearer, I realized the truth. What had looked like trunks and limbs were really the skeletons of houses and stables, all that remained of a village about the size of Caer Vedwood. No people or animals were left. The buildings had been burned to the ground. The stone walls had been torn apart. By the side of the ash-strewn road through the village, a wooden cradle, once the bed of a child, lay in splinters. Why this village had been destroyed, no one remained to tell. We pushed on toward the dark hills. Although I stretched both my ears and my second sight for any sign of goblins, I found none. But that was no cause to relax. The first hint of sunset already streaked the sky. In another hour, night would fall. I could only imagine what creatures might prowl this terrain after dark. Meanwhile, Shim fell farther behind. He kept stopping to rest. I kept urging him to move. His strength was ebbing, just like my vision. Reluctantly, I concluded that we would need to find some sort of shelter before the day ended. Where, though? This desolate plain didn't offer many choices. We continued to trek over the long, gradual rises and depressions of the land. As our shadows grew, so did my fears. Strange howling sounds, half wolf and half wind, reached our ears. Despite my pleas, Shim lagged ever more. At last, as I topped a rise, I glimpsed a village below. Warm yellow torches blazed in the streets, while fires burned in the hearths of low houses made of mud brick. My mouth watered when I realized that the smell of burning wood mingled with roasting grain. Shim approached and traded glances with me. With a joyful cry, he started running down to the village gates. Clumsily, but full of hope, I ran after him. A man, sitting on the ground by the gates, suddenly leapt to his feet as we came near. He was tall and gaunt, and he held a spear. He wore a simple tunic. A thick black beard covered most of his face. But his unusually large, dark eyes were his most striking feature. Even in the dwindling light, his eyes shone eerily. Yet I could not shake the feeling that their light came less from intelligence than from fear. Indeed, his eyes seemed nearly crazed, like the eyes of an animal frightened to the very edge of death.
Bracing himself, the man pointed his spear at my chest. Though he said nothing, his expression was grim.
"We come in peace," I declared. "We are strangers in this land and seek only some shelter for the night."
The man's large eyes opened still wider, but he said nothing. Instead, he thrust his spear closer, nicking the wood of my staff and barely missing my hand.
"We is hungry," moaned Shim. "Hungry and sleepily."
Again, the silent man thrust his spear at us. Only then did I notice the sign behind him hanging at an angle from one of the gateposts. Carved into a weathered slab of wood, it read, "Welcome to Caernehan, Town of the Bards." Below that were inscribed the words, "Here song is ever," but the phrases that followed had been damaged somehow. I could not be sure, but they seemed to have been scraped away. Through the gates, I watched a woman, tall and dark like the man, scurry across the town square. Before she slipped into one of the houses, she paused to beckon to two children, perhaps 4 or 5 years old, their black hair falling over their shoulders. They darted up to her, and the door closed with a slam. It struck me as odd that we heard the padding of their bare feet, but not their voices. The woman, as well as the children, were as silent as the man with the spear. Then I realized that in this entire village not a single voice could be heard. No babies crying, no friends laughing, no neighbors arguing over the price of wheat, the cause of lice, or the likelihood of rain, no sounds of rage or joy or sorrow. No voices at all. The man jabbed again with his spear, nearly brushing the folds of my tunic. I backed slowly away, still pondering the eerie glow of his eyes. Through my frown, I said to him, "Whatever happened to you and your village, I am sorry." The spear slashed the air again near my chest. "Come, Shim, we are not welcome here." The little giant whimpered, but turned to follow me. We trudged across the tundra as wordless as the town of the bards. In time, we left its flickering torches far behind, though its sorrowful silence continued to cling to us. Behind us, sunset draped a curtain of rich purple over Druma Wood. Before us, the dark night swiftly deepened. I reluctantly gave up hope of finding any shelter on this featureless plain, yet I knew that I must keep searching right up to the moment I could no longer see my own staff. Otherwise, like whatever creatures howled hungrily in the distance, Shim and I would have to spend the night in the open. At that moment, I spotted a shape of some sort ahead. It appeared to be a rock, and on the rock, a person. As we approached, I saw to my surprise that it was a girl. She looked a few years younger than Rhea. Swinging her bare feet, she sat on the rock, watching the purples and blues streak the darkening sky. She did not seem at all afraid to see approaching travelers.
"Hello."
She tossed her brown curls that reached almost to her waist. A playful smile illuminated her face. Cautiously, I drew closer.
"Hello. Would you like to watch the sunset with me?"
"Thank you, but no." I studied her bright, exuberant eyes, so different from the eyes of the man we had just left.
"Shouldn't you be getting back to your home? It's rather late." "Oh, no," she chirped. "I love watching the sunset from here."
I stepped nearer.
"Where is your home?"
The girl giggled shyly.
"I'll tell you, if you'll tell me where you're going."
Perhaps because of her friendly manner, or because she reminded me a little of Rhea, I felt drawn toward this spirited girl. I wanted to speak with her, if only for a moment. I could pretend in some remote corner of my heart that I was once more speaking with Rhea herself. And if her village was somewhere nearby, we might yet find shelter for the night.
"Where are you going?"
she repeated. I smiled.
"Oh, wherever my shadow may lead me."
Once more she giggled.
"Your shadow will disappear fairly soon."
"As will yours. You should go home before it gets any darker."
"Don't worry. My village lies just over that rise there."
While we spoke, Shim edged nearer to the rock on which she sat. Perhaps he too felt drawn to her for the same reasons as I. For her part, she did not seem to notice his approach. Then, for whatever reason, he halted and started slowly backing away. Thinking nothing of Shim's movements, I asked the girl,
Do you think it might be possible for us to stay in your village tonight?
She threw back her head with a hearty laugh.
Of course.
My spirits lifted. We had found shelter after all. Just then, Shim tugged on the bottom of my tunic. As I bent down, the little giant whispered,
I isn't sure, but I think something is strangely about her hands.
What?
Her hands.
Not expecting to find anything, I glanced quickly at the girl's hands. At first, I saw nothing strange, and yet, they did seem somehow different, in a way I couldn't quite define. Suddenly, I knew. Her fingers are webbed. The Aklia bird, Hria's warning that shifting wraiths always show a flaw of some kind. I reached for the dagger Hone had given to me. Too late. The girl had already begun to metamorphose into the shape of a serpent. Her brown eyes transformed to red, her skin to scales, her mouth to ruthless jaws. Even as the wraith leaped at my face, a thin veil of discarded skin crackled as it floated to the ground. I drew the knife, barely in time to lash out, as the serpent bowled me over backward. Shim shrieked. We rolled on the tundra, a knot of teeth and tail, arms and legs. I could feel the wraith's claws digging into the flesh of my right arm. Then, almost as swiftly as it had started, the battle stopped. Our two entwined bodies lay utterly still on the ground.
Emrys?
Asked Shim meekly.
Is you dead?
Slowly I stirred. I extracted myself from the grasp of the serpent, whose throat had been slashed open by the dagger. Rancid-smelling blood poured out of the gash and down the scaled belly. Weakly, I staggered over to the rock and propped myself against it, clutching my wounded arm. Shim looked at me admiringly.
You have saved us!
I shook my head.
Plain luck saved us. That and one observant little giant.
Chapter 27 Care Prey. The little light remaining fled swiftly. We settled for the night by a barely trickling stream a few hundred paces from the remains of the shifting wraith. Each consumed by his own thoughts, neither of us spoke. While Shim stared hard at the eroded banks to make sure that no deadly creatures hid there, I mixed a poultice from my satchel of herbs. The herbs smelled vaguely of thyme and beetroot and Bronwyn. Gingerly, I patted the poultice on the claw marks on my arm, knowing full well that she would have done much better. I tried to hum to myself one of her soothing chants, but couldn't remember more than a few notes. I knew, as the darkness submerged us, that my second sight would soon be no help at all. I laid down my staff and leaned back against a rotting tree stump, the dagger clutched in my hand. I hefted the narrow blade that had slain the wraith. Had Hone used it in his labors, or had he carried it just for protection? Either way, I was now twice indebted to him. A few faint stars began to appear overhead. I tried to search for some of Rhea's constellations, made not from the stars, but from the spaces between them. I thought about the Shimora tree, heavy with fruit. The writing on Arbas's walls, the crystal cave, all aglow. Yet all that seemed so long ago, so far away. To my disappointment, the stars were so few and so scattered that I found no patterns at all. Then I realized that even those stars were not growing brighter as the sky darkened. They seemed shrouded somehow. And not by clouds, at least not by ordinary clouds. Something held them back, kept them from lighting this land. At that moment I sensed a faint smoky smell in the air, as if a fire burned nearby. I sat up straight, straining my second sight, but I found no flame anywhere. Stranger still, I noticed that a vague circle of light brightened the area where we lay upon the ground. It came not from the dimly lit stars, but from somewhere else. What else could be shining down on us? Puzzled, I looked closer. Suddenly I understood. The gentle illumination came not from above, but from below. It came, in fact,
from the rotting tree stump. I rolled away. Cautiously, I took a closer look. I noticed a glowing circle in the top of the stump, as though a door had been cut in the wood, allowing the ring of light to shine through.
"Look here, Shim."
My companion strode over. Seeing the glowing stump, he sucked in his breath.
"Now are you sure we camped in the wrong place?"
"I know, but this light feels good somehow."
Shim frowned.
"The snakely girl feels good at first, too."
Then, without warning, the door popped open. From it emerged a shaggy head with a tall brow and dark, observant eyes. The head of a man. The eyes, deeper than pools, gazed at me, then at Shim, for a long moment.
"All right," said the stranger in a low, resonant voice. "You can come in, but I don't have any time for stories."
The head disappeared down into the trunk. Shim and I exchanged looks of bewilderment. Stories? What could he mean? At length, I announced, "I'm going down there. Come with me or stay here, as you choose."
"I stays,"
answered Shim decisively.
"And you should forget this foolery and stays, too."
"It's worth the risk if it means we won't have to camp out in the open."
As if to emphasize my point, the distant howling resumed.
"Supposing this man becomes another snakely snake? Supposing you is trapped down in his hole?"
I did not answer. I peered through the door and into a narrow tunnel. Although it was well lighted, which restored my second sight, all I could see from this position was a rough-hewn ladder leading downward. I hesitated, pondering Shim's warning. The howling swelled in volume. Clutching my dagger in one hand, I put my feet into the entrance and began to climb down. I noticed as I descended that the wooden rungs were heavily worn, as if many hundreds of hands and feet had entered by them. And, I hoped, left by them. Down I climbed, one rung after another.
Soon, a leathery, musty smell drifted up the tunnel.
It was a smell that excited me, for I had encountered it only one place before, in the Church of St. Peter at Caer Murthin. The farther I descended, the stronger it became. It was the smell of books. When at last I reached the bottom, I stared in astonishment, for hundreds and hundreds of volumes surrounded me. They covered the walls and floor of this underground room from end to end and top to bottom. Books everywhere. Books of all thicknesses, colors, heights, and also languages, judging from the varied scripts and symbols on the covers. Some bound in leather, some so tattered that they wore no covers at all. Some formed of papyrus scrolls from the Nile. Some made of Pergamentium from the land the Greeks called Anatolia and the Romans called Lesser Asia, with the feel of sheepskin. Books sat in rows on the sagging shelves that lined the walls. They lay stacked in piles on the floor, so many that only a narrow path remained from one side of the room to the other. They huddled in a mound beneath the heavy wooden table, itself cluttered with papers and writing supplies. They even covered most of the bed of sheepskins in the corner. Across from the bed, a small but adequate pantry held shelves of fruits and grains, breads and cheeses. Two low stools sat to one side, and a hearth to the other. The hearth crackled with a flame bright enough to light the living space, as well as the tunnel leading to the stump above. Next to the fire sat a cauldron made of iron. Bowls, grimy with leftover food, lay stacked beside the cauldron, perhaps in the hope that given enough time they might eventually wash themselves. Sitting in a high-backed chair by the far wall, the long-haired man sat reading. His tangled brows, streaked with gray, sprouted like brambles above his eyes. He wore a flowing white tunic with a high collar that nearly touched his chin. For a moment or two, he did not seem to notice that I had joined him. I put the dagger back into my satchel. The man did not move. Feeling uncomfortable, I cleared my throat. Still, the man did not look up from his book.
"Thank you for inviting me."
At this, the man stirred.
"You are most welcome.
Now, would you mind shutting the hatch to my front door? Drafts, you know. Not to mention the unmentionable beasts who like to prowl at night. You'll see the lock. He paused, noticing something. And tell your diminutive friend that he is under no obligation at all to join us. He need not feel awkward in the least. Of course, it is too bad that he will miss out on my fresh clover honey. Suddenly I heard a slam up the tunnel. Seconds later, Shim stood beside me.
I changes my mind,
he said sheepishly. The man closed the book, replaced it on the shelf behind his chair. Nothing like a good read to finish a day of good reads. Despite myself, I grinned.
I have never seen so many books.
The man nodded. Stories help me. To live, to work, to find the meaning hidden in every dream, every leaf, every drop of dew. I blanched. Had not Bronwyn said almost the same thing to me once? I only wish, continued the man, that I had more time to enjoy them. These days, as you surely know, we have other distractions. You mean goblins and the like? Yes, but it is the like that I most dislike. He shook his head gravely, pulling down another book. That is why I have so little time for my favorite stories right now. I am trying to find some sort of answer in the books, so that Finkaira's own story does not have to end before its time. I nodded. The blight is spreading. Without looking up from his book, he replied, So it is. Sophocles, do you know the Greek playwrights, had a stunning phrase. In Oedipus, as I recall, a rust consumes the buds. And that is indeed what has been happening to our land, rust consuming the buds, consuming everything. He pulled down another book and placed it on top of the first one, still on his lap. Yet we mustn't lose hope. The answer just might lie hidden in some forgotten volume. It's worth a look in every book. He raised his head, looking slightly embarrassed. Forgive the rhyme, they just slip out, it seems. Even if I try to stop making them, I can't. As I was saying, there are sages in these pages. He cleared his throat. But enough of that now. He waved toward the pantry. Are you hungry? Do help yourselves. Honey is on the left, by the plums. Breads of many kinds are there, twice baked in the manner of the Slantos to the north. I've not heard of them, I confessed. Not surprising. The man went back to flipping through pages. Most of those northerly reaches are unexplored and uncharted. And consider the lost lands. There may be people there, most unusual people, who have never been visited by anyone. He bent closer to the book, pondering a particular page. And may I ask your names?
I am called Emrys.
The man lifted his head, eyeing me in an odd sort of way. Called? You say it as if you were not sure it is your true name. I bit my lip. What about your companion? I glanced at the small figure who was already at the pantry, devouring some bread slathered with fresh clover honey.
That is Shim.
And I am Caer Prey, a humble poet. Forgive me for being too preoccupied to be a good host, but I am always glad to welcome a visitor. He closed the book, still observing me. Especially a visitor who reminds me so much of a dear friend. I felt a strange surge of fear as I asked,
What friend might that be?
I was a close friend of your mother. The words fell on me with the weight of anvils.
My mother?
Caer Prey dropped the books on his lap onto the chair. He stepped over to me and placed a hand on my shoulder. Come, we have much to discuss.